Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to today's Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley program brought to you from the Santa Clara Convention Center. My name is Leslie Saul Garvin. It is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Jeffrey Sachs, Director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University and author of Commonwealth: Economics for a Crowded Planet. Dr. Sachs received his PhD, MA, and BA from Harvard University, and is considered to be a leading expert in economic development, poverty alleviation, and environmental sustainability. Currently, Dr. Sachs is Professor of Sustainable Development and Professor of Health Policy and Management at Columbia University. He is also president and co-founder of Millennium Promise Alliance, a nonprofit organization tackling extreme global poverty. Prior to joining Columbia, he spent over 20 years at Harvard, most recently as director of the Center for International Development. In 2004 and 2005, he was named by Time magazine as one of the 100 most influential leaders in the world. A special advisor to UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, Dr. Sachs also served as director of the UN Millennium Project and special advisor to UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dr. Jeffrey Sachs.
Thank you very much. What a pleasure it is to be with you and to share some time pondering some of the big challenges that we face in the United States and in the world. I think it's a very important time for us to be pondering these problems because our political choices this year are going to have a huge effect for our country and for the world for many, many years to come. And I think it's fitting that we have this discussion in the context of this testimony underway about Iraq, because if there is one theme of my book, it's that the military approach is not going to solve the problems that we face on this planet, not even in Iraq, much less the real challenges that we face, because the nature of the instability and the risks that we face have deeper causes that can't be solved by armies. These are problems of poverty, dislocation, bulging populations of unemployed young men, water scarcity, some feature of Iraq and Pakistan and Afghanistan and many other unstable regions, a food crisis which is now becoming clear with soaring food prices, an energy crisis which is now becoming clear, even if President Bush didn't hear it. Yes, indeed, we're nearing that $4 per gallon gasoline, perhaps soon enough he's going to be driving his own car and we'll find out again what people are feeling. But these are critical moments now, and we've been on a wrong course in our country. We've been approaching problems with the very blunt instruments, if you could call the military approach that can't get to the core of the problem. And we've also been thinking of ourselves as standing alone in the world when at the essence of today's challenges lies the need for global cooperation, because not one of the things that I'm talking about today can be solved by the United States alone. Indeed, I don't even really talk about the U.S. as the leader of solutions. I think we have our part to play, but only a part. We're only 5% of the world's population, after all, and there are many, many others who have to be part of the solution as well. But as long as we're constantly saying us versus them, and as long as we're constantly seeing the world as inevitably divided and with all the dark forces out there, a big misunderstanding about the world, then we're never going to find the way to the cooperation that is key. The subtitle of the book, Commonwealth, is Economics for a Crowded Planet. And for me, that is the dominant point of what's special about our generation, how crowded the world is, how we're in each other's faces as never before, and how the impact of human activity on the Earth's physical systems is at a scale that is simply unprecedented and of a character that never existed before. There are, as you know, 6.7 billion people on the planet now. That's roughly 10 times the number of population that there were at the beginning of the industrial era, about two centuries ago. In other words, we've added 6 billion of the 6.7 billion population since the industrial era started, which has been a very recent development. And the amount of economic output and income on average per person on the planet has also risen because of the power of technology, our science, and that's brought a lot of improvements of living standards for us, certainly, and for a lot of the world during this period. The best estimate is that the average amount of output per person on the planet, taking the total world production, dividing it by the world's population, is now about $9,000 per person. Mind you, in the United States, we're closer to about $45,000 per person. In some poor countries, it's just all the way at the other end of $450 per person. But on average, the income in the world is about $9,000 per person when you make appropriate corrections for differences of price levels and currencies across the world. And that $9,000 per person for a 6.7 billion person economy is a $60 trillion world economy. Now, that's the dollars, but what it represents is the vast amount of industrial production, the 750 million or so motor vehicles, each using gasoline and putting out carbon dioxide, the incredible expansion of demand for food, which has transformed the face of the planet and which continues to drive the processes of deforestation as land is cut down in order to make room for new feed grains and new food and new pasture. And we have a story today in the news about how farmers are rebelling against the conservation measures of the past because food prices are so high that they're moving more intensively into more marginal lands than in the past. So this burgeoning world population combined with a burgeoning level of economic activity has created an unprecedented situation for physical Earth on which we depend, even if we sometimes don't recognize it in our cities and living with all of the distance between us and nature due to our technologies and our appliances. If we just went on doing what we're doing right now without change, we would find that already our human activities on the planet are literally unsustainable. We've already reached a point of unsustainability. And the most dramatic case, of course, is the one that Al Gore, more than anybody in the world, has helped us to understand, and that is the carbon dioxide emissions from our use of fossil fuels. That's unsustainable because we're emitting about 36 billion tons of carbon dioxide each year. About six of that comes from the deforestation, especially in the tropics, and the other 30 billion, the vast bulk of it, roughly 80 to 85%, comes from our use of fossil fuels. Now, why is this unsustainable? Because when we put so much carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, the way the Earth's physical systems work is that much of that stays in the atmosphere for a very long time. Some of it dissolves in the ocean and acidifies the ocean and threatens the corals and the marine ecology. Some of it lands on the land, terrestrium, but most of it stays in the atmosphere for quite a long time, and that, of course, leads to climate change. And with the amount of economic activity that we're now engaged in worldwide, that 36 billion tons of carbon dioxide that is being put up each year is raising the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere by 2 parts per million of molecules. And if you look at what that would mean to continue till the end of the century, the alarm bells go off by every knowledgeable scientist who tells us that we'd be passing thresholds of tremendous danger, whether it's of crop destruction, spreading disease, rising sea levels because of melting of ice sheets and so forth. We'd be hitting major crises by the end of the 21st century. That's the sense in which we're already literally unsustainable in our activities. And the same is true in how we're using water, how we're using land, how we're using nitrogen and nitrogen-based fertilizers and so forth. But here's the challenge and really the point. We're not staying still. There's good news and there's very worrisome news, and it's the same news. And that is that the rest of the world is learning how to use these technologies, how to adopt them and adapt them with blinding speed, so that countries that have lagged behind in the past in income levels are achieving remarkable economic growth right now, narrowing the income gaps, which to my mind as an economist and as human beings is a terrific thing, because they're able to use the same technologies that benefit us, but adding remarkably to the weight of human activity on the physical environment. And of course, there's no headline greater than China's dramatic economic rise right now. Just to give you a sense of the magnitude of this, China remains about a fifth of the U.S. income level right now, roughly, maybe 8,000 on average compared to our 40,000 plus. But since China is more than 4 times the U.S. population, 1.3 billion people compared to our 300 million people, they're really narrowing the gap in terms of the overall size of the Chinese economy. And more than that, for the last 30 years, they've been catching up like we've never seen before in human history, with a rate of economic growth per person around 10% per year. If you get out your calculators and you accumulate 10%, like in your bank account, each year, you find out that the doubling time to double per capita income is only 7 years. So they've been doubling the size of the economy roughly every 7 years. You do that for 28 years, that's 2 times 2 times 2 times 2. That's a 16-time increase of per capita income. And there's a lot more economic development packed in there. And as China increases its demands, makes perfect sense, they're still lagging behind us in per capita income terms. That means rising demand for food. It means rising demand for feed grains to feed a rising demand for meat in the diet. It means, of course, a burgeoning of the number of automobiles on the road. And when you take into account that Tata Motors has just brilliantly engineered a $2,500 car, we're going to see billions more cars in the coming decades on this trajectory. So if we're already unsustainable, and yet the world economy by and large is booming, and that's true even if we have our recession, which we will have this year, the world will continue to experience economic growth and will also get out of recession. So this process will continue even if we've got some real short-term pain this year. We're on a path which somehow just doesn't add up. What's going to give? What to do? Indeed, the world economy has been growing at about 5% per year in recent years, averaging our much slower growth, China's much faster growth. We're slower because we're at the technology frontier, pushing it out. China's faster because they're adopting already proven technologies. That's easier to do. So that's what's narrowing the gap. 5% overall, again, take out your Excel spreadsheet or use what we call the rule of 70, divide 70 by the growth rate of 5, and you find out that's a 14-year doubling time. The world economy as a whole is doubling roughly every 14 years right now. So if you think we're unsustainable now, what about in 14 years from now and 14 years after that? And this is the great conundrum. Indeed, my view is that we face three interlocking realities, all global scale. First is good news, we're in an age of convergence. Bad news, in a environment in which human domination of the Earth's physical systems has already arrived. One brilliant Nobel laureate, Paul Crutzen, has called our era the Anthropocene, which is a geology-sounding term, meaning the era driven by human activity as opposed to natural activity. Definitely a bit unnatural what we're doing. Burning up all the fossil fuels, cutting down the trees, outfishing the oceans, moving species around the planet, taking over the nitrogen cycle, taking over the water cycle by more than 50,000 dams of rivers around the world, and so forth. So we have the Anthropocene and a booming economy, point number one. Point number two, the global population continues to grow. The medium forecast of the United Nations is that by 2050, we'll add another 2.5 billion people to the planet. Many of us aren't aware of that because we hear more stories about the so-called baby bust or the empty cradle because of a decline of fertility rates in the rich world. But in the poor countries, and especially the poorest, the population growth remains astoundingly high, enough to be raising global population by roughly 80 million per year. Third, and ironically, with all this economic growth and technology, there are about 1 billion people still stuck in extreme poverty. They're not benefiting from the booming technology because they're impoverished peasant farmers, no access to credit, no access to modern technologies, yet they are suffering the effects of climate change, more droughts, more flooding, more land degradation, and now soaring food prices for hungry populations and food riots around the world these days. Every day you can pick up a story. 2 days ago was Haiti. Yesterday was Egypt. Food riots in Cameroon, in Senegal, in Mozambique. Why? Because the demand for food is pressed up against a tighter and tighter supply, and because in a very misguided way, we're putting one-third of our corn production or maize production in this country into the gas tank this year in what is a completely misguided approach to real energy needs. You don't put food in the gas tank as a way to solve the problems, and yet that's exactly what we're doing by this corn to ethanol conversion. We actually need our food for food. And when we do this, we find out that we create massive hunger for the most vulnerable people, including in the United States, people who are finding food prices soaring and they can't afford it. And we've got a lot of hungry people here, but there are hundreds of millions of hungry people around the world that are directly in this line of fire right now. Now, some books stop somewhere around here and say the party's over, it's all doom. others in my profession who think that economics is somehow about equations written in a classroom and not about the natural world at all, ignore all of this stuff and think, well, it's a matter only of what we do on the finances and what new kinds of derivatives and the stock market and all the rest, and don't understand the interactions of the human systems and the physical systems. I'm trying in Commonwealth to show that there is a path in between these two extremes, and that indeed we have to not give up on the idea of economic progress on the one side, or give up on the idea of environmental sustainability, which is a nonsense because our lives depend on it. So it's not a choice about tree hugging, it's a choice about the reality of our survival. We have to find a way to combine these two seemingly clashing goals. I believe this can be done, and I believe it's not pie in the sky to believe it can be done. The path that I advocate is essentially resource-saving and sustainable technologies, but not just to hope that they're going to come about, not just to dream of miracle or science fiction solutions, but to identify the kinds of things that can be done systematically with technologies already at hand, or those that are close at hand if they can be further developed, demonstrated, and diffused. For me, what we need is not just R&D, though we need that, research and development. We need what's called RDD&D, research, development, demonstration, and diffusion of technologies. We need to see the full value chain of identifying new approaches, showing how they can work, development, demonstrating them in actual practice, and then ensuring that those technologies are diffused and reach the world. A lot of the book is really about that challenge of how we take up sustainable technologies for low-emission energy, which we dearly need, for high-mileage automobiles, for high-productivity food supplies, for far more efficient water use, for solving the problems of our desire for a growing diet of fish, highly nutritious and wonderful for human health, and at the same time the near gutting of the oceans the way we fish right now, of stabilizing a global population, not taking it as something that is just off on its own, but understanding that by helping women to have access to family planning and contraceptive services, by helping young girls to stay in school rather than being married at age 14 and beginning childbearing when they should be in high school, by empowering households to know that they have choices, by helping their children to survive so that impoverished families don't believe that they need to have six or seven children to ensure that a couple survive, but rather they can be confident that their children will survive. I believe we can, on a voluntary base, help the poorest countries to stabilize their populations through a voluntary reduction of fertility rates as well. Now, all of this, in my view, is fundamentally important for our national security, fundamentally important for our own well-being, because we need solutions for food and energy and water ourselves in this country, as does the rest of the world, fundamentally important for our economy, because if we stopped squandering our money in war and instead invested in sustainable technologies, we're also a place that can be technology leader, or certainly one of them, and earn our income the right way in the world by having superior technologies that can be available worldwide. So from my point of view, this is crucial from the point of view of security, from the point of view of sustainability, and from the point of view of our economy as well. Let me conclude by sharing with you my thoughts about a memo to the next president, which I hope the next president reads maybe the evening after the inaugural ball. So January 21st, 2009, a few modest proposals. Let me give you my list of the 10 to-dos that I think come out of this analysis. Number one, end the Iraq war immediately. There's nothing in it. Listen to General Petraeus. They have no approach that makes sense other than time for us to get out. We cannot solve the problems of that country. We provoke problems. We do not solve them. And it's not a great angst. It's time to leave because it was time never to be there in the first place. Second, end the Bush tax cuts. This is $250 billion a year to people that don't need it, depriving our government of the funding that it does need for health care, for hunger, for sustainable technologies, for helping the poorest people in the world. Third, raise our investment in sustainable energy from the meager $3 billion a year that we're now spending, which is 1.5 days of Pentagon spending, by the way, to about $30 billion per year so that we can face up to the challenge of effective solar power, cellulosic ethanol rather than our food, high-mileage automobiles, carbon capture and sequestration, and other sustainable technologies. We need a National Institutes of Sustainable Technology like we have a National Institutes of Health. It's the same motivation and the same possibility. Fourth, send a climate envoy immediately around the world to China, India, Australia, Brussels for the European Commission, Canada, Japan, Russia, to say we're back in the business of negotiating and we want to reach an agreement under the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change and on the timetable that we set last December in Bali, which means by the end of 2009 for the next round of agreement. Fifth, stop the subsidies for ethanol conversion. They make absolutely no sense. We're spending 51 cents per gallon for blended ethanol at a time of world high food prices. Enough. Stop. Six, ask Congress to ratify, the Senate to ratify the Convention on Biological Diversity, which we've never signed, the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, which we've never signed, and to read the Constitution once again to remember that global treaties are national law under the U.S. Constitution. That includes the Geneva Conventions. And maybe when we retire these attorneys general, they'll read this too and remember about international law and domestic law. Seventh, invite the leaders of Senegal, Mali, Niger, Chad, Sudan, Somalia, Ethiopia, Yemen, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Iraq, Pakistan, and Afghanistan, and Southern California, Phoenix, Australia, and other dryland regions to a summit at the White House. What we call the swath of Islamic extremism is the swath of water scarcity. It's the swath of hunger and youth unemployment and dying livestock. And we need an approach to help the poorest places in the world find a foothold for life. I work in those countries. They are not sitting around hating us for our freedom. They are actually wondering where their meal is going to come from, where their food is going to come from, where they're going to get water from, what their children are going to do to survive, what kind of jobs they have for the future. We should call them to the White House, understand, we understand their crisis because we share it in our ways, and we can work together scientifically to approach it. Eighth, reestablish financing of the United Nations Population Fund, which the Bush administration cut off. This is absurd not to be supporting family planning at a time when the population increases in the poorest and most unstable countries are not only a huge crisis for those countries, but also a huge crisis to national security. 9, make the Millennium Development Goals the centerpiece of our international policy, because we promised to work with the world to address the scourges of hunger, disease, and extreme poverty. And yet, despite the promise, despite the agreements, of course, you never hear this from the President of the United States. I think he said Millennium Development Goals perhaps one time, those three words consecutively, in his administration. I happened to be there. We nearly fell off our seats. September 14, 2005 at the United Nations. But beyond that, we've not had leadership in this country for what the rest of the world yearns for. We promised that we would reach 0.7% of our national income, 70 cents out of $100 as development aid, and we're at 16 cents, not 70 cents. Our aid to Africa, you'll be surprised to know, because sometimes you hear, oh, it's all money down the drain. You know how much money we're giving to Africa right now? 4 cents out of every $100 of our income for 800 million people facing the massive crises and at the point of so many geopolitical crises. What we do is we send the military, but aid? Oh, no. Why would you do that? So we don't. Of course, the reason to do it is that we might actually solve problems, because putting counterinsurgency forces in hungry populations does not stop any problem. But with engineers and doctors and public health specialists and agronomists and hydrologists, we could actually solve some problems, even make some friends. And that would be a wonderful thing for our safety. And the 10th recommendation I would make is something I analogize to one kind of worm parasite stuck in our intestines of unlucky people. A particular kind of worm has evolved to suck the blood of our intestines of infected people. And since its whole life is spent in the dark in the intestine, it has evolved to lose its eyesight. And so it just sits there blindly sucking the blood. And that's how I think of the U.S. government sometimes right now. Sorry for the grim analogy, but I sometimes think of us as just blind to the world right now, flailing out without understanding. This is no good. If we can't think, we can't provide for our security, and we can't solve problems. We gutted many years ago our aid agency by squeezing it, lowering its capacity, deprofessionalizing it, driving experts out, USAID. We turned over development aid to the military, who then turned it over to corrupt companies. We have deprofessionalized and taken away the expertise that we need even to see the world. So I'm recommending that we establish a department, cabinet level, for international sustainable development, so we know what we're doing. And I think that this would be a way to open the eyes and actually cooperate with the world and get the job done. Let me close with an observation made 40 years ago, more than an observation, with one of the most beautiful speeches ever given by an American leader, by John F. Kennedy, when he was convincing Americans, and he did it, that we could make peace even with the Soviet Union. We could sign a treaty with the Soviet Union. It became the Partial Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. At a time when Americans thought that war was inevitable with the Soviet Union, that you could never sign a treaty, President Kennedy reminded us that nothing is inevitable about our doom, that we can solve these problems. And the basic reason is that we share common goals, because we're all in this together. Even the Soviets in the Cold War, even Iran and others today, they're facing problems of energy and water and other insecurities. are shared around the world. President Kennedy said the following, and I'll just read an excerpt. "Too many of us think that peace is impossible. Too many think it unreal. But that is a dangerous, defeatist belief. It leads to the conclusion that war is inevitable, that mankind is doomed, that we are gripped by forces we cannot control. We need not accept that view. Our problems are man-made, therefore they can be solved by man. And man can be as big as he wants. No problem of human destiny is beyond human beings. Man's reason and spirit have often solved the seemingly unsolvable, and we believe they can do it again. Let us focus on practical, attainable peace based not on a sudden revolution in human nature, but on a gradual evolution in human institutions, on a series of concrete actions and effective agreements which are in the interest of all concerned." He went on to what I regard as the most important and beautiful words said by any American leader in modern times about why we can find peaceful, cooperative approaches in the world. "So let us not be blind to our differences," said President Kennedy, "but let us also direct attention to our common interests and to the means by which those differences can be resolved. And if we cannot end now our differences, at least we can help make the world safe for diversity. For in the final analysis, our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's future, and we are all mortal." Thank you very much.
And good afternoon, everyone. My name is Kavita Nandini Ramdas. I'm president and CEO of the Global Fund for Women, a San Francisco-based foundation that exclusively focuses on making grants to support women's human rights around the world. So you might imagine I have a strong interest in the issues that Dr. Sachs speaks about. I've also had the pleasure of working with his cousin, Nancy Deo, who has served as the interim vice president for communications at the Global Fund for the last year and a half. In our 20 years of history, we are celebrating 20 years this year, in promoting women's economic independence, leadership, safety, the health and well-being of girls and women, we've learned much about the issues that Dr. Sachs has referred to today, and so it gives me particular pleasure to welcome him and to share with him many of your wonderful questions, which are here today. I hope that the time we have together will give us an opportunity to hear back from him. I grouped the questions in five categories, but I might want to start with a sixth that didn't show up. So the questions that showed up mainly fell into these categories. The large question of poverty itself and some issues around that. Questions around energy and global warming and environmental sustainability. Questions around economics and what might need to change in our understanding of and current practice of economics. A couple of questions about what you, Jeff, might have to say about other authors' takes on particular issues. And then lastly, the sort of what can we do question, which is not surprising from any audience, from a variety of different perspectives. The one I didn't see, and the one I would like to add, because I believe clearly from my own experience that it's so central, is questions around how investing in women's equality and freedom, particularly given the concerns that we've heard Dr. Sachs outline, might be connected to the concerns that we see. Because although you can distribute all of the contraceptives that you want make sure that they're available, if you don't change women's position and status within their families, within their societies, and indeed within their economies, we won't have the changes that we want to see in our world. So that's my playing role of moderator and adding a little piece that isn't there. Let's start with some of the questions around poverty, Jeff. Would you please, here's one of them, would you please summarize the lessons being learned from the UN Millennium Villages that you have been so involved with? And what do you see as some of the major challenges?
Thanks a lot. Great list of questions, and we'll come to yours, Shirley, too, in some detail. The Millennium Villages is an initiative to apply the recommendations of the UN Millennium Project, which I directed on behalf of then-Secretary General Kofi Annan. We made recommendations on how to make investments to help the poor get out of the trap of extreme poverty. And those investments focused in areas of improved agriculture, since most of the poor are actually farm families. Health, since the disease burden is pervasive and one of the cripplers of human well-being and a source of poverty itself. Education, since that is the long way pathway out of developing the skills for more productive life and higher incomes. And fourth, basic infrastructure, roads, power, internet connectivity, and so forth. And when we made that set of recommendations, we also decided to put the recommendations to work on a local scale in a number of countries to demonstrate how they could be effective. So the Millennium Villages were started in 10 countries in sub-Saharan Africa. Now they're reaching about 15 countries. There are about 500,000 people within the project. The idea is seeing help as an investment, not a handout. We don't give out food aid, for example. We don't give out clothing or shoes. We don't build houses. That can all be very meritorious, but this is something else. This is to give tools to the poor for their future. And the results are quite remarkable. First, and I would say going on too long, it's possible to help impoverished smallholder farmers that have a tiny little bit of land to be vastly more productive than they are by enabling them to gain access to improved seed varieties, to fertilizer, to other agricultural technologies, treadle pumps for water and so forth, which can all contribute to doubling or tripling their productivity and being the difference between being stuck in hunger without even enough food to bring to the market, much less to eat, enough to eat, much less to bring to the market, to having a food surplus which can then be sold on the market. And that can happen quite quickly. Other things that can happen quite quickly are reducing malaria and other disease burdens because they're powerful, straightforward techniques. Getting children in school, if the school fees are dropped, and if some classrooms are built, if girls have hygiene conditions, their own latrines and so forth separated from the boys, if they have sanitary napkins, in some places girls don't go to school for days per month because they have no sanitary napkins even to attend school. Simple things, very low cost, can make a huge difference. One thing we've learned, it's not perhaps a shock, but it's so dramatically evident every day, without electricity, there is no possibility of really getting out of extreme poverty. So most villages do not have any electricity at all. It's pretty much unimaginable what that means until you're in those conditions, because the most basic things, of course, the refrigerator at the clinic for the cold chain for the vaccines, the pump for the water in the midst of a dry spell, the connectivity that one needs to be able to make a phone call from a village of thousands of people out to the rest of the world, either from an emergency or a quote on a price of a crop or something else, all depends, of course, on having electricity present. And this can come in a variety of technologies. What we're learning is that real progress can be made, but it's not free. It is within that 70 cents per $100 that we promised to give and that we're not giving. So we could help all impoverished villages to meet the basic platform on which economic development occurs, but they don't have even that basic platform right now, and that's why children die by the millions by the millions because they're too poor to stay alive right now.
Jeff, let me move us to a question that I'm sure you're very familiar with that is raised often by people who are concerned about the issue of getting aid to the places that need it the most. How does one ensure that these resources actually reach those who need it the most and are not siphoned off by a few? So the question of corruption, access, and that goes for money, food, and products.
Yeah, perhaps the main answer is don't send it through Washington.
Seriously.
If we talk about mega corruption, it's the billions in Iraq and in Afghanistan and so forth given to politically connected to this administration that are absolutely incompetent or just stealing the money. I don't know which, although we can't underestimate the incompetence factor with this government and its friends. And so this actually is part of the problem. Now, I do believe, incidentally, Washington doesn't have to be so miserably incompetent as it is right now. My advice to the American people is let's stop electing presidents on the basis of who you'd like to have a beer with, because have a beer with who you'd like to have a beer with, but try to elect a president that knows something. But I'm going to come to the question of what happens when it gets to the impoverished places, because part of it gets siphoned here, part of it gets wasted in expensive advisors and so forth going, which is not the point. What we need mainly is actual physical commodities like bed nets, like medicines, like bags of fertilizer, like improved hybrid seed and so forth to solve practical problems. And if those things are delivered in physical quantity rather than giving over envelopes of money, there is a tremendous track record of success. After all, we eradicated smallpox 30 years ago, not in a few demonstration projects, but in every village in the entire world, everywhere. UNICEF has succeeded in reducing measles deaths in the last 7 years by 91% in Africa. People who say it can't be done just don't know very much. What it requires is a proven technology, a delivery mechanism, adequate financing of the technology, not just a blank check, but adequate financing of the technology, monitoring, oversight, and feedback. This is all within very normal means. There's nothing magical about it. It's a bit of basic systems thinking. And if we do it right, we get excellent results, as we're getting in malaria control in many places now. Many other diseases could be brought down enormously. Malawi, little Malawi, impoverished, poor as can be, has succeeded in more than doubling its food production in the last 2 years through a voucher program to help impoverished farmers get a bag of fertilizer and a tin of high-yield seed. This can be done anywhere where we're thoughtful about it, and we need to start being thoughtful about it.
Jeff, could you speak to, just on that topic, there have been research done by both Oxfam and others showing that currently the way U.S. aid money works is that almost 70 cents on the dollar actually comes back to the United States because of practices such as requiring that even food, so when Jeff speaks about concrete differences, so even food aid must be transported all the way from the United States on U.S. carriers with U.S. Requirements, so that if people are starving in Ethiopia and Kenya actually has the grain to help them, instead of CARE or any international organization being able to simply purchase that grain in that country that's close by and transport it to where people most need it, it's actually restricted, and it sometimes takes as long as 6 months to get food to those countries. Is there something we could be doing to put more pressure on how our own government uses more sensible mechanisms to make a difference?
Everybody knows the ancient proverb of give a fishing rod rather than the fish. With respect to food in particular, we should not be shipping food aid abroad. We should be helping Africa to double or triple it's food production because the technology exists and because it's roughly one-tenth the cost of doing it that way rather than sending expensive food from Iowa. It just makes no sense. What's happening in Africa is that farmers can't get access to a bag of fertilizer and improved seed, and that would be $100 a hectare, which is about 2.5 acres, and could give another couple of tons of grain, and yet to ship that same amount from here might not be $100, might be $1,000. And so we just need a sensible policy. Our policy is, of course, driven by farm state interests. But frankly, enough of the farm state interests right now. The world food prices are at all-time highs. They don't also need the ethanol subsidies, and they also don't need to hinder the ability of poor countries to grow their own food. So I don't think farmers really want to do that, and I don't think that thinking representatives of the farm states want to do it, but we have programs in place that are just subsidies built on top of subsidies built on top of subsidies, and now we have nearly $1,000 per ton wheat. This doesn't make sense. We need to rethink this whole approach.
So that brings me to another question around the issue of economics and the cost of food. One of our members in the audience says, rising food prices are bad for consumers and good for producers. Since most third world economies are agricultural, wouldn't this result in a net gain for most third world residents?
It results in a net gain for certain countries which are net exporting countries like Brazil or Argentina right now. Even within those countries, of course, the large non-agricultural population can suffer a lot of dislocations from this. But from the aggregate of the country, if you're a large net food exporting region, then higher world food prices are beneficial. But remember that Africa is a large net food importing region, and that the truly impoverished, the poorest of the poor in Africa, who are farmers, don't even grow enough food for themselves, much less to bring to market. They are non-commercial. So when the food prices go up, they're not the recipients of that benefit, but the people in the cities are big losers. So in Africa, this is no benefit right now because Africa is not a food exporting region. It's a food importing region. And the poorest are living at subsistence. This is quite important to understand. The beneficiaries, to the extent that there are, would be the middle income, more productive countries like Argentina, Chile, and Brazil.
Let's move to the question of energy and environment for a second. Given the critical importance of energy to agriculture, water, sanitation, health, etc., you just spoke about electricity, why did sustainable energy not get more prominent visibility in the MDGs, and what are you and others who are closely involved with the MDGs trying to do about that?
Well, the Millennium Development Goals were a compilation of goals that were put in front of the world by Kofi Annan in the year 2000, building a lot on various international conferences and programs of in the 1990s. We don't have a global energy institution that is properly tracking this. That's part of a lack of international architecture, you could say, institutionally. And so infrastructure was not put into the Millennium Development Goals. Since I was asked by then Secretary General Kofi Annan to lead a worldwide effort to figure out how to implement the goals, the first thing I said to our team and to global leaders is anything that's needed to achieve the goals has to be considered to be part of the goals. So you can't will the way without willing the means to do it. And so in our project, we had lots of studies and recommendations on electricity and on the power sector and on safer cook stoves and on many, many other things because those are crucial for the Millennium Development Goals. Even though power doesn't appear in the list of the eight goals, it's vital to achieve the goals, and it has always been considered that way. And fortunately, a major effort underway this year, led by the Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, president of the World Bank, Robert Zoellick, and many other world leaders, has put a very high profile on raising funding for electricity, especially for power generation and distribution in Africa, because it's amazing that, as I said, most of rural Africa has no electricity, and some cities essentially have no electricity or no reliable electricity. And the interesting thing I should say about that is that if you think about renewables, there is one commodity that Africa has in the world's leading abundance by far, and that's solar radiation. Just the sunshine coming into Africa is enough to power all of Africa and the rest of the world, or I should say the contiguous world at least, because there are plans of how Europe's electricity could be run off of distribution from North Africa, for example.
So you like this next question.
Yes.
Other than a failure of national will, is there any practical reason why the United States should not have a solar array atop every government building in the country? And what should be the role, I'm adding two together, of federal, state, and local governments in taking the lead on some of these environmental issues?
Well, let me say that on solar, the big problem right now is that solar is more expensive than fossil fuels. And the gap has not been closed yet. And there's the intermittency problem, which is that with solar, you not only have to produce the solar power, but you have to store it for the nighttime. And there are ways to do that now, and more technologies to use the daytime solar for nighttime storage. These are technological challenges that are part of normal science and engineering, extremely important. They require some billions of dollars of investment to get right, both from the public sector and the private sector. This is obviously a major area for our security, our well-being, and our economic competitiveness that we need to get right, that we dramatically underinvest in right now. It has been estimated that the sunshine in the Mojave Desert, if mobilized by what are called concentrated solar thermal plants, of which there's one right now, or one cluster, could provide more than half of America's electricity needs in the future. A wonderful article in Scientific American in December discussed a nation-scale solar plan. There's a lot of work to do to make that possible, but it's within realistic engineering vision. And it could be a wonderful investment if the technologies evolve the way and are developed the way that it looks is quite possible. But we're hardly working on it right now. Of course, we essentially have an administration which has ducked all of these issues for its entire term.
I'm going to take the privilege of inviting you back to the question that I asked around.
Wonderful. Good.
Around women's participation, leadership, and whether you see in the work that you've done, as certainly I have, the creativity and the solutions coming from the ground up, and what role do you see women's equality and freedom playing in this transformation that you envisage for our world?
Well, Kavita, no one's done more on this than you, and so we're all enormous admirers of your leadership in this area. And I think the basic points, again, are a little bit of arithmetic. First, the women are half the world, so depriving half the world of the opportunities, the energy, the outlook is a disaster for all of us. Nobody can afford that. But as you know very well, women are not only half of a village or half the world, but much more than half the work, if we're frank about it. So if you look at the amount of hours actually spent in hard physical work, it's the women doing it. Fetching the water, fetching the fuel wood, caring for the children, cooking, farming, weeding, it's endless and it's backbreaking, and it's women doing it. And so a lot of the investments that I'm talking about, whether it's electric mills for the milling of the grains, whether it's electric pumps for irrigation, whether it's fertilizer for the staple crops, whether it's a clinic within the village rather than 10 kilometers away, whether it's an anti-malaria bed net so the child doesn't get malaria in the first place. These are all pro-women investments. Be sure of it, because the women are bearing the burdens in every one of those cases incredibly disproportionately. We find in our villages that when we, of course, insist on equal representation in the village committees as part of the project, but then the women come to the leadership for. It's not just that they're half the representation, they become the natural leaders in the village, because, again, they're doing more than half the work, and they end up, even the men end up supporting them, because the men want to see the work done too and get some better results in the villages. So we've had many women become heads of executive committees in the Millennium Village project. But there's obviously a tremendous amount to do. There is lots of cultural change. Sometimes people say development shouldn't be about changing cultures, but certain parts of culture need to be changed, in my view. And one is the incredible bias against girls and women in a lot of parts of the world. So that's something that is a traditional carryover from a subsistence village stuck in endless poverty, but it's not something that I believe functions in the 21st century.
Thank you, Jeff. And so maybe amongst the various treaties that we'll get our new president to sign will be the Treaty to End Discrimination Against Women, which
there
the United States has not signed as well. Time for one last... No, are we out of time? I'm sorry about that. I thank everybody for your attention, and I thank Dr. Sachs for having given us such a wonderful insight into some of the most challenging problems.
Thanks so much to you.
I hope you enjoyed today's program of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we would like to thank Dr. Jeffrey Sachs, Director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University, Kavita Ramdas, President and CEO of the Global Fund for Women, our audience here in Santa Clara, and those of you joining us on the radio. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley is adjourned.